And welcome back. There are a great many socioeconomic political problems in this nation that need fixing. Many Americans are frustrated by the way our system is or is not working. The current stalemate in Washington is an example. Top-down solutions are elusive on so many levels. Our next guest will argue that a new, potent, bottom-up, grassroots approach could be more effective. We welcome Jeffrey Stout of Princeton University to talk about that. He's professor of religion at Princeton, and he takes on this subject in his book, Blessed Are the Organized Grassroots Democracy in America. Professor Stout joins us from Princeton. Professor, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Don.
Well, you know, I think given what you've been writing about and what you've been talking about, there are few times that I can recall when the American people would feel less powerless than they do right now, given what's going on in Washington. What's your advice to them?
Well, my advice is to get their acts together. Let's put it that way, and which is to say, to connect with organizations on the ground and to build up their power so they aren't just a bunch of isolated individual voices. If you're if you're completely atomized, if you're if it's just a bunch of separate voices, you're not going to get much done.
In your book, you give many examples of where this has worked. Give us some sense of some of the things that you're aware of where this kind of people power, this organization, has made a dramatic difference.
Well, the best place to start is just to think of the major social movements that have transformed the political landscape in the U.S. over history. So go back to the movement to abolish slavery. In 1930, abolitionism was basically a collection of lawyers centered in Philadelphia. And after two decades of organizing, the center of it had shifted to New England. Almost everybody in New England was organized on a face-to-face basis, and then major changes started to happen. The civil rights movement's another example. The battle for women's suffrage. Take the civil rights movement. Most people imagine that what we're really missing is something like another Martin Luther King to come along. But if you think about what really happened in the mid-50s in the civil rights movement, before there was a Martin Luther King as a public figure, there was a Rosa Parks, and Rosa Parks, before she refused to move on the bus, was in a citizenship school organized by Miles Horton, the great civil rights organizer. 40 years of organizing were in the background of that, of the successes that started to come to fruition then.
One of the things that occurs to me, Professor, however, is the fact that certainly those examples you cite took a lot of time, and it does take a lot of time to organize a lot of people. And, you know, we're dealing with crises today that that need to be resolved today.
That's right, and there's no shortcut to resolving them. What you're seeing is part of what you're seeing is the product of a mistaken assumption on the part of the people that that all of this can just happen through the political parties. And when the political parties, especially when the political parties are basically hijacked by big money, even in the relatively populist forms of organizing, it's really largely a top-down effort, especially when you trace the money. You're not going to get much change that way. So this is not to say that you have to start from scratch. There are a lot of organizations out there, beginning with churches and synagogues and mosques and labor unions and parent-teacher associations and neighborhood associations. And what I've been doing is studying things like that and looking at how they have begun to transform the landscape politically at the local level in various places.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So, and that, you know, there are very hopeful signs down there below the radar level, below the point at which these things are being covered by the media. And that's not to say that they have networked up to the point where they have the kind of national power to intervene in the contemporary crisis.
Particularly,
so there's a gap.
Particularly, as you suggest, with the now that corporations are people, as decreed by the Supreme Court, one corporation can have a lot more clout than a great, great many people.
Well, that's right. And the CEO, just think of what a CEO is. A CEO is somebody who has an enormous amount of power because of his or her ability to provide financial incentives to people through wages and salaries to cooperate with what the CEO wants done. That's a kind of organized power. And when the balance tilts completely in that direction, toward what we might call money-influenced power, and that ends up through a series of court decisions and other developments to have an enormous impact on the political system, everything starts to tilt. And there's only one possible solution to it, which is some other form of organization.
Let me just bring up the Occupy movement,
which
is I think it kind of represents what you're talking about. Started small, but stayed small. It never really caught fire. What happened there? Why did it not become more of an influence, do you think?
Well, it's analogous to some of what happened in the Arab Spring. So you had a you had a bunch of people coming together. They were not very well organized. In fact, the anarchist strand of the Occupy movement was initially skeptical of the very idea of having leaders or of having representatives of any sort who could speak for the group that was gathering. It turns out that that kind of loose organization almost never has large-scale transformative effects. So take the example of Arab Spring for a moment. You had a bunch of people who were kind of like the Occupy Wall Street folks, loosely organized, gathering in Tahrir Square. You also had them joining together with the Muslim Brotherhood and various other groups that had been organizing on a face-to-face basis for 40 or 50 years. It's no surprise that after the Mubarak regime collapsed, the people who actually had power to begin filling the vacuum were the Muslim Brotherhood. They were organized, and not in this loose, leaderless sort of way.
Well, I suppose we could then look at the Tea Party, which is causing such havoc in Washington right now, as being more analogous to the Muslim Brotherhood and the fact that it did develop some leaders rather quickly. Even though it's small, it's really having a tremendous influence.
It's having a tremendous influence, but it's also, when examined closely, surprisingly top-down, which is to say it's funded by a few billionaires, and they have had a very heavy hand in pushing this along. It's also, of course, closely synchronized with right-wing talk radio. So the part of what's happening at the moment is that the people who have, a bunch of the people who've been riled up by the Tea Party organizing to join in their own form of populist spirit are refusing now to follow the tune of the billionaire funders. This is one of the most interesting developments of the last couple of weeks. When the Koch brothers have decided, no, we mustn't go into default, recognizing that their financial interests would be very seriously harmed by default, the populist wing of the Tea Party is not going along.
Just out of curiosity, how do you see this thing unfolding over the next couple of days? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's very hard to tell, but part of what is going on is that the people on the right, so the largely suburban right-wing Republican congressmen, they have a very clear sense of what forms of threat they will face from organized power on the ground if they don't live up to the expectations that have been created for them. There's nothing similar to that on the left. Nothing similarly powerful. So I'm guessing that that Obama is going to have a hard time stiffening his spine when the final moment comes as the deadline approaches. We'll have to see. There's an interesting story. Back when he was campaigning for the presidency the first time round, he met with a group of potential donors in New Jersey and recalled a story that goes back to the Roosevelt administration. Roosevelt was having a conversation with A. Philip Randolph, the greatest American organizer of that period. And Roosevelt asked Randolph, what would you do about the issues relating to racial segregation? And Randolph said something quite a bit. And then Roosevelt said, you know what? If you want that to happen, you're going to have to make me do it. He didn't mean to be discouraging. He meant that a president needs to be pressured by people outside the political parties in order to achieve large-scale, important forms of change.
That's interesting. That's the second time I've heard that story in the last 24 hours. That is popping up a lot. Make me do it. Just make me do it.
Make me do it. Yeah. Make me do it.
Our time is somewhat limited, but I want to give listeners a chance to come into the conversation in the few minutes that we do have remaining at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air.
I encourage the viewers to come hear me talk about this stuff.
Absolutely. I have the information right in front of me here. You'll be presenting the Lee Institute lecture in St. Louis at the Ledoux Chapel on Clayton Road on October 28th. That's going to be at 7:30 in the evening. It is free and open to all. And we have information on our website at stlpublicradio.org. So that's on the 28th at 7:30 at the Ledoux Chapel for Professor Jeffrey Stout. What about the religious component to what you're writing about here, Professor? How does that play into the whole scenario?
Well, one thing I realized when doing my research, and especially in poor communities, if you're not just going to start from scratch, you've got to ask, where does organizational power exist that's outside of the big corporations? And one of the main places is in religious communities. That's one of the main places where people gather, where they help each other become leaders, so on and so forth. In all of the great social movements, the religious communities have played major roles on both sides of the issues. So they're not to be neglected as important sources of political power. And one thing I found in studying the poor communities is that the religious institutions are just about the only place where poor people have to gather at the moment. So that's the key.
Do these institutions have the clout today that they might have had 40 years ago, let's say?
In many places, not. But part of the religious landscape is changing fairly rapidly, and it's hard to tell exactly what's going to happen with this. But in the citizens' organizations that I'm still keeping an eye on in places like Texas and New Orleans and Chicago and on the West Coast, I'm seeing a very interesting pattern developing with, among other things, mosques joining these citizens' organizations. So mosques, synagogues, Catholic parishes, Protestant congregations. It's a very, very interesting development and quite unlike the Tea Party suburban, almost entirely Protestant organizing that traces back all the way to Karl Rove. Anyway.
And what are the issues that you're finding today, aside from the political things that we've been talking about that are hot right now? What are the issues that these emerging groups seem to be most concerned about?
Well, the form of organizing that I'm studying most closely involves finding issues on the fly to see the people go in. They try to figure out what people are really concerned about. And, of course, to some extent, that's a local matter, but they all have something to do with disproportion in economic power and the impact of that disproportion on politics and local communities. So there's a lot of worry about debt these days. There's a lot of worry about how developers are taking over whole communities. Of course, in New Orleans after Katrina, many issues that have to do with the difficulty of people coming home after the flood, a lot of issues surrounding immigration and so on. All of these things are in many ways connected.
We spoke earlier about the speed or sometimes the lack thereof of getting these things organized and really rolling. It would seem to me that social media today would change that and be kind of a booster rocket to some of these organizations.
Social media can help, but it can also be a temptation or a trap. If it helps people organize on a face-to-face basis, then it works. And it's very clear now, increasingly so, that when it's used as a substitute for that, it doesn't.
I want to remind our listeners that we are listening to St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. What about the question of leadership? It seems to me that there's always a danger of being co-opted somehow by having the wrong person emerge as the leader of any of these groups.
Well, this is one of the most important things to look at closely in how these groups differ from each other when you look at the various varieties. The groups that are completely suspicious of leadership, they don't do well. The groups that have extremely strong leaders who find themselves in positions of low accountability, let's say, those groups don't do very well either. They either fizzle at the point when people just get alienated from the leadership and walk away, or they become anti-democratic. So the groups that do well tend to have rotating leadership and very well-developed practices of holding their leaders accountable. They need leaders because they need people who can speak on behalf of others after earning the authority to speak on behalf of others by listening to them and holding themselves accountable to them.
Accountability is a word that you used a lot in this last these last comments, but it's also a word that pops up a lot in your book. It is a most important ingredient in all that you're talking about, isn't it?
That's right, because if the basic problem in our society right now is one of domination, which is to say some people and groups are in a position to act as they wish, arbitrarily exercise power over others, the antidote to that is accountability. But we already have a good start given our system of government, which separates powers and so on among the legislative executive and judicial branches. We have elections. We have a Bill of Rights. All of those things provide the infrastructure in which accountability can happen. But it doesn't really happen unless people organize and exert pressure on the political system through organized real power.
Which is basically what your book, Blessed Are the Organized, Grassroots Democracy in America, is all about. Jeffrey Stout, professor of religion at Princeton University, thanks so much for being with us. Enjoyed talking to you. And
thank
we'll
you, Don.
Let folks know that you'll be presenting the Lee Institute lecture in St. Louis at the Ledoux Chapel on Clayton Road on October 28th at 7:30. Free, open to all, and we have information on that event on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Once again, sir, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about efforts to alleviate hunger as well as the political issues surrounding it. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.